Yeah, it is.
All right. Back in the cemetery.
Back in the cemetery.
We are going over, walking through the old section of the Evergreen Historic Cemetery to a particular headstone whose name escapes me. It is Donald A.
Cannon.
Cannon.
1860 to 1910.
1900.
1900. Yes, thank you. Sorry. Gone but not forgotten. No. Clearly, because we're here.
Yep. We haven't forgot you, sir. And we haven't forgot your slave-made bricks underneath here.
Right? What's up, Donald? Calling you out.
All right, Donnie Don. We are going to retrieve your bricks, sir. Maybe not.
I want to say, for those of you who aren't here witnessing this, Nigel's muscles are bulging out of his body. He's definitely not straining.
All right. So which is the one? That's the one?
This is the one. Yeah. Okay. Handprint. Also interesting other thing.
Hey.
Welcome back, listeners.
Welcome to the Materialist Podcast. This is Nigel Rudolph, Public Archaeology Coordinator with the Florida Public Archaeology Network Central Region here in beautiful, gorgeous Gainesville, Florida. And my co-host is?
I'm Mandy Wagner-Pelkey, and I am an Outreach Coordinator with the Central Region of Florida Public Archaeology as well.
This is the, this is season four-ish of the Materialist Podcast, and we are coming at you with episode two. And those of y'all that are just joining us for the first time, the Materialist Podcast is a sort of archaeology-centered podcast where myself and a co-host and special guests and folks, we talk about material culture, archaeology, Florida, Florida history, you know, try to make it interesting for people to learn about the world around them and the material culture that we take for granted every day that surrounds us daily. But we are here once again recording in lovely Gainesville, Florida. And today we are going to be talking about something very interesting related to cemeteries as usual. But before we get started, let's jump to some check-ins about a recent event that FPAN hosted here in Geeville at the amazing Depot Park. Shout out to Bailey Bruce for all her help at Depot Park. What did we have? What was it? What did we do?
We had the Crypt Conference here at the Depot Event Space in Gainesville and Evergreen Cemetery in Gainesville.
And so what Crypt Conference is it's a two-day event. Basically what we do, first day is we open it up to speakers, people read papers talking about cemetery or cemetery-adjacent archaeology work or cemetery resource work, to academics, to interested cemetery preservationists, to students. All kinds of people share their ideas, articles or whatever about historic cemeteries. And this year we were blessed to have a number of descendants from local cemeteries come and sit on panels. I moderated a couple of panels focused on different aspects of local historic cemetery preservation, including fundraising and such. And it was really excellent. Day two of the conference is a field portion. And day two for this year, as Mandy mentioned, we were at the historic Evergreen Cemetery here in Gainesville, which is just conveniently down the street from Depot Park, where we held the main part of the conference. And it was also a beautiful, cool morning. We had a great turnout. How we had it set up was there were four or five stations. One station was for cleaning, learning how to clean headstones, learning how to properly use the right materials. Then we had a station that was doing ground penetrating radar that was run by our colleague down at the West Central office, Richard Ott. And then we had a tour, kind of roving tour group of the old section of the historic Evergreen Cemetery that was done by the cemetery manager, Karen Press, with the city of Gainesville. My little nifty station was resetting headstones. And so I picked two headstones, and one of them was really crooked. The first one was really crooked. It was really big, very heavy. So I brought out the tripod. It was exciting. People asked questions. Lots of good information. Mm-hmm. I had some help from the Central Florida Cemetery Project folks. They came and lent some assistance to that station. We reset an amazing headstone, and then I wanted to do another one. And so the next one was a much smaller one. I didn't want to get out the tripod. I wanted to make it something that I could just pick up and move to show variety of the different tasks that you often encounter when you're doing cemetery restoration work.
To demonstrate your muscles,
yes,
as well.
And I was, yes. Yeah, I wasn't wearing a muscle shirt, but I should have been.
Right, he wasn't wearing a shirt at all.
Yeah,
he was
right.
Shirtless.
And like I said, I should have
been. Bulging, veiny muscles.
Yes, indeed.
Lifting headstones.
Indeed.
Going,
yeah. And and so right before I started, my muscles were bulging. Right before mm-hmm. that, I was discussing with those that were there that occasionally when I'm moving headstones, I will find things, objects that have been placed beneath the grave markers to support them historically. This was an attempt to stop them from sinking into the ground because it's just sugar sand. Well, what happens is those objects sink into the ground and then the headstone sinks in the ground. And so right before I moved this one headstone, I was discussing this. And then I moved the headstone, ready to start, resetting, really simple project. I got out my probe, my handy dandy metal probe, and I was probing the area, and I hear a tink. And lo and behold, there was something underneath this headstone, something that was placed there based on the death date of the headstone. Was what was it?
1900.
So whatever was placed beneath this headstone was most likely placed there 124 years ago. All right. Perfect example, perfect opportunity to demonstrate this other factor that comes in with some simple cemetery preservation work. What did we find, Mandy?
So underneath the headstone, we found a row of four handmade bricks.
Yeah.
Yeah. We pulled them out of there, and
mm-hmm. they weren't just bricks that you would buy, or perhaps they were bought, but they were very unique because they had finger marks in them. So mm-hmm. they retained the marks that whoever was making those bricks out of clay, when they were shaped, retained their fingerprint. So that was very exciting because now you see this direct connection between a human being and this material object. Mm-hmm. You actually saw the swirls. In one of the cases, you could see the swirls from the fingerprints. So it was a lot of really interesting information, and it was a really fantastic opportunity to show this to the people that were observing the work. But it also opened up a mystery.
A mystery.
What dun, dun, dun. Are these? Did they purchase these bricks from a local brick factory? Where was the local brick factory? Was there a local brick factory in Gainesville? Was there one in the broader Alachua County? We don't know. We're going to try to dig in a little bit deeper to figure that out, aren't we, Mandy Wagner-Pelkey?
We are absolutely going to do that. We're going to dig deep into the mystery, learn about bricks.
All right. Stay tuned. I'm looking at one of the bricks right in front of me, actually. It's big. It's brick-shaped. Mandy went into explicit detail about it.
Well, it's hard to describe to listeners, or it's hard for listeners to know what the heck we're talking about. Like, people are going to visualize just a brick. And it's not just any brick, Nigel. It's It's this brick.
It's that brick.
It's this brick.
Let me, very special brick.
Let me explain.
You're going to sum it up now?
I'm going to explain what's so special about this brick. So,
go.
The brick, it's almost the size of a standard modern brick. The size, this brick is, it's 8 inches long, specifically a little less than 4 inches wide, 2.25 inches high. That's pretty close to a standard brick. It's actually a little longer than a modern brick. So the surface of it is really rough. It's got a lot of almost like gouge marks in it, cracks. I would say it's like an orangish tan color, just like to look at it. What do you think?
Yes.
Okay. So on the Munsell chart, the Munsell soil chart, it's about 5YR56.
Oh.
Yellowish red.
That's for you non-archaeologist people, listeners. There's this very expensive book that we use to document soil colors called the Munsell. And that's it. That's the whole story.
Yeah. And it's actually, there's a lot of variety in the variation in the color. Like on one side of it, it's more tan. On one side of it, it's like orangish on one end and yellowish on the other end. And then like on this end, it's almost reddish.
Right. And you remember yesterday when we were talking about the variety in colors. Now that was hand dug, hand shaped. And then it was put into a kiln. And so where it was in the kiln could have some reasons why there's so many variations in the coloring. This was probably a coal-fired kiln. And so as the flame is moving around the kiln, heating up the bricks, heating up the clay, the oxidation within the kiln is going to change. So it'll be heavy oxidation in one place, very low oxidation in another place, and what we call a reduced atmosphere. So there's more fuel than there is air. And vice versa, there could have been parts of the kiln that had more air than fuel. And so that's going to bring a lighter color. The reduced atmosphere in the kiln is going to bring darker colors. It's going to pull that iron-rich minerals that are inside the clay body, pull that out to the surface. And so that's why there's so many variations.
So what's up with these little spots on it?
Those were probably either materials that were mixed in with the clay. That's just straight iron. So it's just iron was pulled out. And so that whatever burned off, the iron was left, those little spots. But it's hard to say, but you can. Mm-hmm. The University of Florida does have a materials analysis lab in St. Augustine, and that would be very interesting to get that analyzed more, to get the specific ingredients, like the specific components of the paste.
Yeah, it's each of these on the brick, there is like a smattering of darker reddish brown spots that are about the size of a pencil eraser, and each one of them has a little pinhole in the middle of it.
Yep.
So like whatever inclusion was in there burned out,
popped out. Yeah. So if it was calcium, like a high calcium content, that would have popped out of the brick. Sometimes what can happen is that could blow a chunk out of the brick depending on how much is in there. So if there was a large amount of limestone in the material, like chunks of limestone, which is basically just pure calcium, it would just pop itself out. It happens to pottery too, ceramics as well.
So, and I just noticed as I'm sitting here handling the brick that it's really the dimensions of it are really irregular. Like on one end, it curves up on one side, and then on the opposite face of the brick, it curves up on the opposite side of it. So it's not it wouldn't lay flat. If you were building a house with it, it would, it would be curved.
Yeah. Which tells us what?
They didn't build a house with it.
Right. Yeah. And it's handmade.
It's handmade. The other thing that tells us that it's handmade is this handprint.
Yes. There's fingerprints on it.
And this one, so we found 4 bricks and I believe all 4 of them had fingerprints in them. And, but this particular one has nearly an entire handprint in it, and you can see where the brick maker held the brick. Their fingerprint left their impression in the clay, but you can see where the palm of their hand wrapped around the side of the brick, where their pinky and ring finger rested on the top of the brick, and possibly even where their thumb rested on the the backside of the brick. It's a really clear handprint. It's extra cool because it's about the exact size of my hand. So
a 20-something young woman.
Yes.
Was
yes,
probably a, making that.
Mm-hmm. Definitely a 20-something, maybe even a little bit more youthful.
Yes, with, perhaps. Perhaps.
Very soft hands that have not seen a lot of hard work.
But what's really amazing about those what's really amazing about those fingerprints is that it's like a direct physical connection to the human beings that made that brick. And so that's what was so intriguing to me is when we saw it, was very rarely see it in this kind of thing. And occasionally you'll find it when you're looking at indigenous pottery, pre-colonial indigenous pottery. You'll every once in a while find a little fingerprint if they're making some kind of decoration on it with their fingers. And sometimes you can even see the swirls from the pads of their fingers.
We don't know who the individual was that right. made this brick, but we can physically connect with them. We know what their fingerprints were, mm-hmm. which is pretty amazing to have that record of a person that, I mean, unless they are like Methuselah, maybe they are no longer with us.
No, but they had beautifully well manicured.
No hangnails, no dirt under their fingernails at all.
So no let's scars. Jump back real quick into kind of give the listeners a little bit of a backstory to not only the brick, but also the city in which we found it. We are coming at you this afternoon from the FPAN Central Studios, a.k.a. our spare bedroom, my office, home office. It's an absolutely beautiful day up here in North Central Florida, so we have the windows open. So if you hear some background noises, just bear with me. We're not coming in a sterile environment here. We're of the people. We're of the earth.
We're just like you people.
We're just like you. So we found this at beneath a 124-year-old grave marker. As we mentioned in the intro, this was probably original. The bricks were originally placed on there. The brick, I'm assuming, was placed on there 124 years ago when the headstone at the cemetery was placed. We recovered this during a workshop at the cemetery with permission from the city of Gainesville. We were working in the historic Evergreen Cemetery. Now, just quick backup, if y'all don't know anything about Gainesville, this isn't Gainesville, Georgia or Gainesville, Texas. We're talking Gainesville, Florida. Gainesville was established round about 1854, round about when the railroad was brought in by a gentleman by the name of David Levy Yulee, who was a horrible person. Levy County, Yulee County, all named after him. But he brought in a railroad that ran from Cedar Key to Fernandina Beach up there by Jacksonville, and Gainesville was right in the middle. So he proposed to have the railroad come through the county seat of Alachua County, which used to be at one point in time the largest county in the state of Florida. The county seat was in the city called Noonansville, which is up northwest. It's east of Alachua. Noonansville, it doesn't exist anymore. There is a cemetery. There is an African-American cemetery there. There is a beautiful a white cemetery there as well, and it's on the National Register of Historic Places. And actually, some archaeologists from FPAN West Central and from the University of Florida are doing ground-penetrating radar looking for the old Seminole War Fort that was there as well. That's how Noonansville got started, as a little Seminole War, Second Seminole War, or as the Seminoles view it, one continuous occupation of their land. And so when the railroad came through, the county seat moved from Noonansville to Gainesville. That killed Noonansville, basically disappeared off the map. So that's where Gainesville is, okay? And so this is the oldest, this brick was recovered from the oldest cemetery in the city of Gainesville, where all the founding fathers or whatever are buried in Gainesville. And it was in the old section of the cemetery, way in the back. It's an absolutely beautiful cemetery, by the way. If you ever find yourself in and around downtown Gainesville, I highly encourage you to check it out, the historic Evergreen Cemetery. It's gorgeous. It is a municipal cemetery, so it's free and open to the public to just walk around. Absolutely gorgeous grounds, beautiful oak trees, lovely headstones.
And just next to it, there's a African-American cemetery called Pine Grove, and it is equally beautiful. So early industry in Gainesville was largely based on citrus and Sea Island cotton primarily. Then, of course, the big citrus freeze came in and killed off all the citrus, so it was all about Sea Island cotton. The downtown Gainesville burned a couple of times, and it was originally all built out of wooden structures, and then they rebuilt much of it out of brick. And so when we recovered this brick, we were wondering where it came from. What was the brick manufacturing areas in and around here? And there was one. Mandy, tell us about Campville.
So Campville is I think that it's actually considered a ghost town now, even though I think the living people that live there would disagree. Campville is a little tiny town, about 10, maybe a little more than 10 miles east of Gainesville. There's a handful of beautiful old houses there. But the Camp family moved to Campville in the 1800s, and they established a lumber mill out there, and then they established the Campville brick manufacturing plant, and also a clay pit for the brick manufacturing plant. Yeah. And the brick manufacturing plant opened in 1885,
they said.
And was open until 1940.
And they lied, didn't they?
They did. They did lie. Oh, they the said, drama.
Yeah. So there's drama. There's always drama in Florida, y'all. We all know this. But the camp people, the camp folk, camp brothers, claim to be the only brick factory in the state of Florida at that time, and that was completely not true. There were a total of 6 brick manufacturers in Florida during the antebellum period, so that's, you know, prior to the Civil War. 4 were around Pensacola, and this comes from an article in the Pensacola News Journal from 1981. November 4th from 1981. And there's also this amazing article in the Florida Historic Quarterly from January of 1974 that talks all about the brick manufacturing around Pensacola, which is where my alma mater is.
Oh.
Anyway, so they weren't the only brick manufacturers in the state of Florida, but they were one of them. And so what our challenge is to try to determine where this brick came from, where it originated.
Right. When we first pulled the brick out from underneath the headstone and saw that there were fingerprints in them, my initial thoughts went to the handprints that we see in bricks from plantations.
Yeah.
Where the bricks were made by the enslaved folks at the plantations and often by enslaved children at the plantations. There's an old plantation homestead here in Gainesville that a brick was found at that has a handprint in it. Historic Hale Homestead.
I actually have a 3D print of the brick right up there.
Of course you do. So that's immediately where my mind went, and then realized that the headstone was from 1900 and the handprint, unless that was a really big child, the handprint is not that of a child. What did you think, Nigel?
I thought the same thing. You know, enslaved labor, we're talking 1900. As you may or may not understand and realize, officially slavery ended post-Civil War, but there was a lot of ways that slavery was continued, particularly in the labor industry and farming and et cetera. And Florida was one of the most notorious states in the South that sort of kept it going in many different ways. However, there's no way to prove that, to identify that. So we reached out to an expert on the subject. And believe it or not, there are experts that specialize in things like bricks. Years ago, I had met Dr. Sam Wilford up at the Division of Historical Resources. His official title is Deputy State Archaeologist and Archaeology Collections and Conservation Supervisor at the Division of Historical Resources in Tallahassee. So Dr. Wilford, Sam, we'll call him Sam here. Sam is a brick expert, and his knowledge of bricks is absolutely fascinating. So we reached out to him, And Mandy asked a ton of questions. First, we asked them general questions. Like, well, Mandy, why don't you do that part? Because you communicated with him more.
Okay. Well, so we started off by, we just sent him the pictures of the bricks that we had taken initially at the cemetery, which, because we didn't really know what we were looking at, weren't super good pictures. So right. We just knew they had handprints in them. So what Sam said about the initial pictures, well, he agreed that they were very interesting, of course. and he said, yes, they're handmade and they look to be made of soft mud. Sam said soft mud is the earliest form of clay used to make historic bricks and is typified by its high water content, which is why the handprints would have remained in the brick.
Yep.
So,
and all the gouges.
Gouge away. You can gouge away. Stay all day if you want.
The tool marks, the things that I kind of just thought were gouges, he says that they are, well, that they're tool marks, that one of the marks looks like it was cut from the mold before it was drying or to remove an imperfection from the brick. And going back and looking at the brick, yeah.
That. Yeah, there's big chunky chunks taken out.
Yeah. And that there's a seam on one of the bricks and there's clear, I mean, I wish that y'all could see this, like an angled, I don't know if that would have been the corner of another brick that's squished into this one or a tool used to lift a brick off of it. You know, there's marks where some sort of tool like pushed through.
They will see it. We will post it on the Instagram.
Mm-hmm.
Loads of pictures from every angle. We did photogrammetry yesterday. I haven't gotten the 3D image all processed yet, but I will post that also on the Insta.
Mm-hmm. We also have a brief interview with the brick on the Instagram.
That's
where
true.
The brick discusses the things that it loves. And you can get a good look at the brick and a good idea of its personality.
Yep,
from that video.
That was the FPAN Central, or was that the Materialists?
That's the FPAN Central.
FPAN Central Instagram, at FPAN Central. Check it out.
So the really cool thing that Sam said, because we assumed that the brick was 1900,
right.
Because the headstone was 1900,
right.
Or pretty close. And so what Sam says is that that's a little late for soft mud bricks, because the industry had moved toward stiff mud and automated mills. And he says that his guess would be that these bricks were from an earlier brick pile between 1820 or 1870.
Fascinating. Antebellum period there.
Fascinating. Definitely before the Campville Brick Factory opened.
Mm-hmm. The plot thickens.
The plot thickens. What's a word that clay people use about clay getting thickened?
Thixotropic.
Thixotropic. That's the exact. Thank you. Thank you. God, I don't know why I couldn't think of that word.
I don't know how I pulled that out of my ass.
So, you want to hear the bajillion questions that I asked?
Yes, let's go through the bajillion questions.
Darling Sam, who very patiently answered all of them. I don't think that he realized that he was dealing with someone with the excitement level of a golden retriever when it came to things like bricks. But he was. So I asked Sam, was soft clay a locally sourced clay? And Sam's answer is, the clay used for soft mud bricks was usually locally sourced in Florida, especially given the lack of transport infrastructure in early 18th century. Soft mud refers more to the clay making process, which for these types of bricks meant that there was a lot of water added to the clay to help it mix. Additives known as clinkers were often added to help the clay fire and solidify, which may include small bits of charcoal, cinder, and ash.
Fascinating. Clinkers.
So my next question to Darling Sam was, what did brick makers use post soft clay? And he says there are some avant-garde brick makers across the U.S. that have returned to making soft mud handmade bricks, though this is very specialty. We asked Sam, R.J. Camp and Brothers operated a big brick manufacturing company east of Gainesville between 85 and 1940. And a lot of Gainesville's buildings at the time were constructed using their bricks. Would they have been slow to change their manufacturing methods because Campville, Florida is. It's in the middle of nowhere, and Florida tended to be really behind on things. Yeah. I was wondering if maybe it
still
it was...
is. It's so strange.
You know, we're pretty quick and very advanced.
Very advanced.
Very advanced.
So I was
here
wrong.
In Florida.
You're right.
I mean, you know, it's hard to take things back in time the way that we are if you haven't gone very far forward.
Time travels.
Mm-hmm. So I was thinking maybe it was a handmade brick from 1900 because we were slow. We're slow. And he says that could certainly be the case. And then suggested that we discover if any of our bricks that we found look similar in color or texture to bricks found in historic structures in Gainesville,
and
which we did.
So we did.
Bricks. The most interesting thing that we could ever possibly do a podcast on.
An ATM stole my card one time.
Stole your card?
And I cussed it and made a scene.
That's good. I'm sure that changed things.
Yeah. All right. So what are we doing here at Mojo?
Wow.
Mojo Delicious Mojo Barbecue.
Mojo.
Whiskey Bar.
Is it Mojo Dojo? Mojo Dojo Hogtown Brick Factory?
That's it.
We're checking out some bricks here. I found online where a lot of the bricks in buildings downtown came from the Camptown Brick Factory.
Campville
Brick Factory. Mm-hmm. The Campville Brick Factory is east of Gainesville, about, 10 miles?
It's Have Gun Will Travel. It's my boy. That's my buddy's band playing.
All right,
go ahead.
Cool, I'm glad that you interrupted me to say that.
Campville.
So Campville is a little town, 10-ish miles east of Gainesville, on the other side of Noonan's Lake. And in the 1800s, the Camp brothers moved from somewhere else and opened up a lumber mill and brick factory. And they made bricks out of the clay that's over there near Campville. And it's kind of yellow, tan, orangey. Yeah. And that's where, rumor has it, a lot of the bricks in the downtown Gainesville buildings came from.
And
those bricks, the bricks here at Moho Mojo Hogtown Barbecue, are very similar in color to the bricks that we found underneath the headstone.
Yep. They sure are.
Yeah. So we're looking for any similarities.
Shiny.
Yeah. I think some of them have been replaced. There's like a patch of them over there. Yeah, you can see where, like, up top.
Yep.
Where these are different.
Those are the OG.
The OG.
The OG are up top.
Campville.
Yeah. All right. I wish we could go in and eat some barbecue.
Yeah. Do you see any, tool marks that look like...
No.
I bet the people that work in there right now think that we're real weird.
Yeah, that guy's staring.
Yeah. Inclusions.
Yeah, so that's grog.
Temper.
So this is what they used as they were recycling bricks. And they crushed up old bricks and put it in the paste or the clay mixture that they made the present bricks out of as a temper.
Oh, that's so cool.
I smell weed.
Me too. Stay on track.
Stay on target.
Yep, we're here.
And the last question, I mean, I asked Sam a lot more questions, but these are just the ones that that seem worthy of including. We wondered if the shift from handmade bricks to industrial brick making was related to the emancipation of enslaved folks, the cost of labor changing with the emancipation of enslaved folks. You no longer had people that you could just demand that they that they make things for you. Sam says that it could have been a factor, but probably the largest push was demand, as not only were bricks needed for structures, but for roads and industrial units too. He says standardization was also a big push as model building codes were adopted. So all bricks that performed a certain function had to be made to certain sizes, weight, etc. Almost as if they wouldn't have wanted to use this curvy, wavy brick.
That's interesting. I wonder if it was like a reject and they grabbed it from a reject pile.
Oh.
Because it is kind of f***ed up.
It is. It is a little f***ed up.
It's not flat. It's no. Definitely not flat. Yeah. It's like a smiley face.
So those were the questions that we had for Sam, and he gave us fantastic answers.
Thank you, Sam.
Thank you so much,
and
Sam.
Thank you to the Division of Historical Resources in Tallahassee. Thank you to State Archaeologist Katie Meyer for the work that she's doing.
Mm-hmm. And I would like to add that we considered having a voice actor portray Sam.
Right.
Because Sam is a British man, but we didn't.
And yes.
We still probably should have.
As we all know, if someone speaks with a British accent, they are more intelligent.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and we wouldn't have wanted to feel,
No.
Yeah.
So speaking of intelligence, I nerded out. Let me back up. We don't know where the brick was manufactured, if it was brought in from, say, a plant in Pensacola, or if it was made from the Campville factory, or if it was a reject pile from some handmade brick place that never got on the map. We don't know where it came from. And so what I did is I wanted to look to see if the area, the vicinity of where the Campville brick factory probably was located, if the soils there would have been conducive to harvesting clay for brick manufacturing. And so, as you all know, or maybe if you don't know, Mandy didn't know, that the USGS did a entire soil survey of the entire state of Florida. I'm assuming they did every single state. But in Florida, those are all on the University of Florida Smathers website, and you can get all the historic soil documentation. And it's really, really cool if you're a super nerd. So I went looking through there. And basically, the area where the Campville brick factory was vast majority of it was very poor drained soils. So some of the names are La Clusa Fine Sand, Surrency Sand, Pomona Sand, Pomona Depressional, Spar, Pelham, and Noonan Sand. Those are all poorly drained. There is one little patch of well-drained soils sort of to the east side of it. But obviously, well-drained soils would have been ideal for setting up like where the structure would be, or perhaps having, you know, where roads could be. But poorly drained soils were where the clay was. And so this area indicated on the soil map called Pelham Sand, number 13 Pelham Sand, is poorly drained. Down about a meter is where you'd find very, very clayey, sandy loam. So that points out that this was probably the location of where they were digging the clay from, but they could have been digging it from all over. And as we noticed in some of the bricks that we saw that were definitively from the Campville site, there was a lot of inclusions. There was a lot of stuff mixed into the bricks, including chunks of old bricks. So, lots of temper, or what did he call them?
Clinkers, yes.
That didn't answer any questions, but nope. They definitely could have harvested the clay from that area, but they would have had to add a lot of things to it. And so if you think back to how indigenous people made their pottery utilizing the clay throughout Florida, the clay is pretty poor. So they had to add things like different tempers, sand, limestone, shells, etc., to allow the clay to hold up to not only being made into an object, but then through the firing process. So we're not talking like Georgia clays, like up there in the panhandle, they got that red clay, that red, you know, Georgia clay, real high clay content. We don't have that here. We have some, a little bit of it here, but not a lot of it. And so they had to add a bunch of junk to the clay to make it work.
Yeah. I don't know if anybody else knows this, but Gainesville is a bit of a swamp.
It is.
Yeah.
I think
yeah.
they called it that at one point in time.
I feel like it's something I've heard batted about. All right. So as Sam recommended, we walked around as Dr. Samuel Wilford.
Sorry, Sam.
As Dr. Samuel Wilford recommended, we went around to see if we could find similar bricks PhD. And other historic buildings. Well, that's what the doctor meant.
Yes.
Yeah. Nigel.
Thank you, Mandy.
See, that's why we didn't want Sam here, is right. because we would...
Because we're jackasses.
We're very, very intelligent. Mm-hmm. And you wouldn't have been able to tell if Sam had been here.
Right.
So, anyways... All right, so we went to walk around downtown yep. Gainesville to see if we could find similar bricks, because according to the city of Gainesville's historic preservation documents, a lot of the buildings in downtown Gainesville are made from Campville brick. So one of the buildings that is definitely made from Campville brick is now Hogtown Mojo Barbecue.
Jim.
Yeah.
Delicious barbecue, by the way. Shout out to Mojo Barbecue.
Mm-hmm. They have really good sides too. Anyways, so we went and checked that place out. Something about those bricks though is that they had a lot of inclusions in yeah. them. They had a lot of things added to them.
Clinkers.
Clinkers that you could see on the surface of them. That's not the case in the bricks that we found.
Right.
So they look really similar. They're similar in color. They're kind of similar in texture, but they're different. They're definitely different.
But I wonder if that's because of what Sam was saying about bricks being architectural versus for roads. There's different standards of bricks, and so maybe they had to add those clinkers in there to make it hold up for architecture. I don't know.
Right. I mean, that building, it was built in 1900, and it's still standing. And I think that if someone had built a building out of these bricks that we found, I don't think it would be still standing.
Yeah, certainly not be level.
Those buildings aren't around for us to look at anymore. So we did a little bit more walking around to see what we could find. The old Opera House, which is now Harry's restaurant.
Right.
Also delicious. Their bricks are painted over. A lot of the bricks downtown are painted yeah. or plastered over. But we were able to look in a door down a hallway. We weren't being creepy or weird nope. at all doing this, looking in behind the maintenance person. We were being totally normal. Mm-hmm. And we could see a brick wall, but the bricks on that wall were definitely a darker color.
Yeah.
But that building was built in 1900, and I suspect that those bricks are a darker color because fire.
Fire. You mean like when the city caught on fire?
Yeah.
That's interesting. that might be the case. Yeah, it depends. That might be the case.
But we don't know. So we continued walking around trying to find similar bricks, and we did. We did find some bricks that looked really similar.
I got a $20 Impossible Burger.
He did. He did get a $20 Impossible Burger. Nigel
was a mistake.
He makes good choices all the time, y'all. So, Palomino Pool Hall.
Right.
Yeah. We walked around Palomino, which is also painted over mm-hmm. and covered in plaster, stucco. Mm-hmm. I don't know the
plastery
difference.
Plastery stucco.
Plastery stucco, yeah. And we were, again, not being creepy or suspicious.
Nope.
And we were walking around the back of the building and happened to run into a friend who said, go look at them. A friend who worked there. Thank you. Thank you, Ronnie Holmes. Thank you. So we got to go look at the bricks in the back of the building. And there is like a smallish area above a doorway
yeah.
where the bricks are exposed. There were a lot of different bricks.
Lots of different bricks, including like what looked like some modern ones.
Yeah.
But there was definitely ones that were very similar and had the tool marks.
There was at least that one brick that was it was this color, Nigel.
Exactly.
It was this color. And it had tool marks that looked like the ones that we see in this brick. Like it, and I mean, it was probably a level brick.
Right.
Because it was in a building.
A curved one.
But it was a brick that clearly looked handmade.
Yeah.
But it was in the same rows as bricks that looked like they were clearly manufactured.
Yeah. So, you know, it's still a mystery. My wondering is that I wonder how accurate the color is on this because it's been underground for 124 years, where the other one's been on the side of a building.
Right.
So
that's been plastered and then had plaster chipped off and
painted.
Yeah.
Nap, like cigarettes. Who knows? Like all this stuff has been adding to
the patina of the brick. So we fully expected to find, looking up in the property appraiser records, that the building that is Palomino Pool Hall was really old.
Yeah.
Like a lot older than Hogtown Mojo and the Opera House. Mm-hmm. But
it's not.
It's from 1930. So, and looking at the old Sanborn fire insurance maps, shout out to Sanborn fire insurance maps. Yeah. They're always there for me. There was nothing in that spot where Palomino is in the 1800s. And the last map that I looked at was 1922. And that was the first time that there was something there in the Sanborn maps.
Deuce.
It was a filling station, a Standard Oil filling station.
Interesting.
I don't know if the Standard Oil filling station was torn down before 1930. Maybe there were some leftover bricks from Standard Oil.
I guess what it boils down to is we have got a lot of answers, but nothing specifically answering our query, our initial query. I don't know.
Yeah, we don't know.
It's a really cool brick, however, and I'm glad we had the opportunity to take it out of the ground and examine it much more closely. And it really proves that these little pieces of material culture, this is an artifact, straight up, tell us a whole bunch. They provide a ton of information. So we wouldn't have known hardly any of this information had it not been for the discovery of this brick. These things are living. Us finding this brick is part of the life of this piece of material culture, and us examining closer the history of brick manufacturing in and around this area is part of its story now. And so we will put it back in the ground, and it will go back under there for another 124 years.
And maybe then, the next people that dig it up will be able to figure out something.
Yeah. I bet they'll have like a laser. It's probably lasers involved.
Definitely lasers. They're gonna do some science at it.
Mm-hmm. Anyways, we're wrapping it up.
Yeah. Thanks for listening.
Thanks, listeners, for listening.
Yep. I'm sure everyone now agrees that bricks are infinitely more interesting than they thought they were. I know I do.
I do. So, listeners, you find us on iTunes, Google Play, Podbean, and Spotify, as well as Instagram and the Facebook. Please like us and share. Mandy is doing a kick-ass job at social media with both the Florida Public Archaeology Network's Central Regions page and soon to be for the Materialist page. Interact with us. Shoot us a message. DM us, as the term is, correct?
That's what. Yeah, yes. DM. Slide into our DMs.
Slide into our DMs and ask a question. Oh. And if you would like us to speak about something or do an episode on something specific, slide into our DMs and shoot us with a topic. If you would like, on the other hand, to reach out to us via email, our email address is materialistpodcast@gmail.com. That's materialistpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you to the University of South Florida and the University of South Florida Department of Anthropology for our jobs. Thank you to all the FPAN regions out there. Again, huge shout out to Sam up at DHR in Tallahassee. Thank you for all your insight, and I'm sure we'll hit you with far more questions than you can handle at some point.
And a special thanks to Mr. Donald Cannon.
Yes.
For having a grave.
Yes, thank you, mm-hmm. Mr. Donald Cannon, and to his descendants for the grave and for prompting this mystery that is still a mystery, but is
still a mystery.
Very cool. Intro music was Silver in the Age of Opulence, used by permission from Have Gun Will Travel. Find out more information about them on Facebook at HGWT Music or on the web at hgwtmusic.com. I'm going to put a lot of this information in the show notes, links to those articles that I mentioned earlier, the Florida Historic Quarterly from 1974 talks about the bricks up in Pensacola. And anything else we chatted about will all be in the show notes.
I want to add in, you know, because we did have two questions on our Instagram.
Yes.
We answered one of them, but we can include, okay. You know, that you can poke it in there.
Poke it in there.
So the Pop in DC asks, hear about some of notice the brick makers were children. Does this appear like an adult size hand? Which is an excellent question.
That we is had a the great same question. Yeah.
Yeah. And Histories Matter, Adrian.
Oh, Adrian Burke.
Asks, do the bricks have anything like a name that would give a clue as to where they were made?
Nope. Just a brick.
This brick didn't give us any clues into anything at all.
No stamping. That's why we have jobs. And that's why you're tuning in to the Materialist Podcast. And we'll catch you all on the flippity flip.
Bye, y'all.